Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Liberation in Ramadi. Iraqi army units supported by Sunni tribal fighters and a mostly Shiite police brigade have captured the center of the Anbar province capital of Ramadi after weeks of protracted battle against Islamic State militants. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iraqi state TV broadcast grainy footage of government forces climbing onto the roof of Ramadi's municipal headquarters and raising the Iraqi flag. The city center fell to Islamic State militants in May when soldiers defending the same government complex fled. Provincial Governor Suheib Rawi addressed residents of Anbar. He says that retaking the government complex from Islamic State marks the start of the liberation of the rest of Anbar province. One military commander told State TV that Islamic State militants had booby-trapped many buildings and attacked his men with car bombs. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Iraqi commanders are now setting their sights on retaking Iraq's second-largest city of Mosul from ISIS, but officials warn that the fact that a relatively small number of ISIS fighters have been able to fend off a much larger force for so long with such a large level of destruction is a worrying portent of things to come. A twin bombing in the Syrian city of Homs killed at least 19 people on Monday, with a suicide attacker detonating an explosives belt as onlookers assessed damage from the first blast. The explosions hit the central city of Al-Zahra district. The precise death toll remains unclear, with Syrian state media reporting 19 killed, Syrian Observatory for Human Rights citing 32 deaths. This is VOA News. South Korea and Japan have reached a deal settling the controversial dispute over Japan's forced prostitution of Korean women during World War II. The deal includes an $8.3 million compensation fund for the 46 surviving former sex slaves and an apology from Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Two people were killed and three others were wounded when Kenyan military officers opened fire on a car traveling in Mandera County on Monday. Mandera County Commissioner Frederick Shizia told VOA's Somali service that security forces suspected the car of carrying explosives before shooting the two occupants. But eyewitnesses say those killed were civilians and that no weapons were found in the car. They say those injured were passersby. At least seven people were killed Sunday as the Nigerian army repelled another Boko Haram attack on Maiduguri. 20,000 have been killed by Boko Haram. Burundi's government negotiator and the opposition came out of the first session of peace talks in Uganda divided over the question of international peacekeepers. Elizabeth Polat reports from the State House in Uganda where the talks were held.
Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni gave the opening remarks, saying that while he recognized the sovereignty of Burundi, it could not be a reason for inaction on the part of the international community.
1 million people dead just here in Rwanda. And we were watching, what could we do? Because if you come in, you are invading the sovereign country.
The Burundi government delegates say they are fighting insurgents who had attempted a coup. They also say the government is within its rights to look for those perpetrating violence. However, opposition members and many citizens say the government is committing extrajudicial killings, torture, and political violence. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The next round of talks are scheduled for January 6. However, Burundi's government said it has yet to commit to the date, and further consultations must take place before continuing dialogue. Officials in Afghanistan say a suicide bomber struck on a road near Kabul's airport today, killing at least one person and wounding several others. The French news agency reports a Taliban spokesman that says the militants were responsible for the attack. Afghanistan and Pakistan have pledged to jointly work for an early resumption of peace talks between Kabul and the Taliban and sternly deal with insurgent groups who refuse to quit violence and join the process. The pledge came Sunday during talks in Kabul between visiting Pakistani military chief General Rahil Sharif and Afghan leaders. And China's parliament has passed a controversial anti-terror law requiring foreign technology firms to comply with government requests for information. That includes encryption keys that turn digital data into unreadable code. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Inter-Burundi Dialogue was officially relaunched in Uganda early this morning at the President Museveni's State House in Entebbe in efforts to defuse the current political crisis that has rocked the country since April.
That's reporter Moses Javier Amina in Bujumbura. Details coming up.
Also, truckloads of Boko Haram extremists struck Maiduguri in northern Nigeria today with rocket-propelled grenades and a number of suicide bombers.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Guinea-Bissau, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Burundi's government and opposition negotiators ended the first session of restarted peace talks in Uganda, divided over the question of international peacekeepers. Lisbeth Pala reports from the State House in Uganda where the talks were held.
Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni gave the opening remarks, saying that while he recognized the sovereignty of Burundi, it could not be a reason for inaction on the part of the international community.
1 million people dead, just here in Rwanda. And we are watching, what could we do? Because if you come in, you are invading the sovereign country. In Kenya here, people died, we couldn't do anything. Here in Uganda, Idi Amin killed 800,000 people. Nobody could come in. We were dying under sovereignty.
The Burundi government delegates say they are fighting insurgents who had attempted a coup. They also say the government is within its rights to look for those perpetrating violence. However, opposition members and many citizens say the government is committing extrajudicial killings, torture, and political violence. Violence erupted in Burundi last April after President Pierre Nkurunziza made a bid for a third term, despite the constitution limiting presidents to two terms. Nkurunziza was able to run on a technicality and won. Since then, waves of violence have grown increasingly troubling. The African Union has authorized sending 5,000 peacekeepers to Burundi. François Nyamoya, the Secretary General of the MSD opposition party, says the peacekeepers are needed to go forward.
Il faut absolument que la force.
Nyamoya says the African Union forces need to arrive to secure the population's well-being. He says this will be a condition if dialogue has a chance to continue. Government negotiator and foreign affairs minister Alan Nyametwe says no to peacekeepers.
The issue of troops has been dealt with, and it is not up to the opposition to call for troops. Since when? In which country? Let them say whatever they want, but I can tell you that issue has been resolved. The people of Burundi have rejected it. The government has said no. How can they deploy without the consent of the government?
Monday's session brought together some of East Africa's political heavyweights. Officials from the African Union, United States, European Union, United Nations, and East African community came together alongside Burundi's government representatives and the opposition. The next round of talks are scheduled for January 6th. However, Burundi's government says it has yet to commit to the date, and further consultations must take place before continuing dialogue. Lisbeth Pala for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Burundians are monitoring the reconciliation talks in Uganda in hopes that they'll help restore peace in the country. In Bujumbura, reporter Moses Javier Mina spoke with some Burundians about what they think of the talks.
The Inter-Burundi Dialogue was officially relaunched in Uganda early this morning at the President Museveni's State House in Entebbe in efforts to defuse the current political crisis that has rocked the country since April. More than 300 people have been killed and thousands have fled the country after President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial move to run for a third term in the office that violates the country's constitution. Here is what Joseph, a capital resident, had to say.
According on how things are developing, we want this dialogue to be productive. We want the government to listen to the opposition and come together for a solution. I'm a student. Now, we the youth, our future doesn't look bright ahead. The government said we recruit 300 teachers next year. It's not going to be well if things don't improve, even though foreign countries should come in to help Burundi for development.
Another Bujumbura resident, Fiona, had this to say.
What I think, in my opinion, is that there are many negotiations in Kampala. We don't expect much in Burundi ongoing in my country, and the members of the government should respect the Arusha agreement. Our president should leave power. It's painful to see dead bodies on the streets. I want the opposition to focus on Nkurunziza to leave power.
Burundian hope for peace and stability rests in the outcome from the dialogue, considered the only option to defuse the current crisis. The dialogue under Mr. Museveni's mediation started on July 14th. It was suspended after the Burundian government began preparing for the presidential elections that handed the incumbent a controversial third term in the office.
On dialogue, some should sacrifice so that they can come to a common goal, because without sacrificing or one party leaving for the other, they won't be productive results.
After the official restart of the reconciliation, the Burundian parties are expected to meet in Arusha in January to try to find the lasting solution for the peace and stability in the country. For VOA Africa, I'm Moses Habyarimana in Bujumbura.
A Norwegian rescue ship this morning delivered to the Sicilian port city of Palermo nearly 1,000 migrants rescued from floundering boats off the coast of Libya. According to rescue workers, altogether 931 migrants were rescued in four operations over the Christmas period. Among the migrants were 64 women and 35 minors, rescuers said. Two of the women were pregnant, they added. Local media reports said some 136 of the migrants were of Moroccan origin. The group also included one Egyptian and one Tunisian citizen. The majority of the migrants were of sub-Saharan origin. The IOM reports that as of December 22nd, the number of refugees and migrants arriving by land and sea in the European Union has passed 1 million this year, and almost 3,700 have died or gone missing.
Several countries in the Horn of Africa are the first beneficiaries of the European Union's Trust Fund. It's geared towards fighting the root causes of this year's massive wave of migration to Europe. The EU plan is to establish better border controls, improve economies, and integrate displaced and refugee populations in countries like South Sudan, Ethiopia, and Uganda. David Arnold reports from Washington, D.C.
The European Union is investing $2 billion in an effort they believe will help reduce illicit migration. The funds will be invested in economic development, border controls, and surveillance of terrorism. European leaders started talks with Horn of Africa governments last month at a conference on Malta. The European Commission spokesman for international cooperation, development, humanitarian aid, and crisis management is Alexandre Pollack. He talks about the EU's goals.
The fund has really four types of actions. The first one, indeed, is to support on the economic side, so to create more economic opportunities. The second is the social side, gives really more access to basic social services to the population. And then the third one is to strengthen the capacity of our African partners in the field of border management, trying to tackle as well smugglers and that are trying to send people to risk their life, you know, to cross the Mediterranean. The fourth is the security part, to fight against radicalism, more working with the government, with the civil society as well, on the security sector, so that there is a possibility as to increase intelligence gathering and support to the services that are trying to reduce radicalization in these countries.
The causes of African migration vary. Much of Eritrea's exodus is attributed to youth trying to avoid long years of forced conscription in a very poor country. Polak says Ethiopia, Somalia, Uganda, and South Sudan present a mix of other issues.
If I take the example of South Sudan that we're mentioning, support to the stabilization through improved resources and management of the authorities. If I take the example of Ethiopia, it's a mix of action, but one, for instance, it's to strengthen Somalia's responsiveness in management and integration of flows of refugees. I don't know, a third example in the issue of Uganda. Here it's more about, you know, supporting refugee settlement and host communities that are in northern Uganda, that, you know, that is prone to security issues. People need protection, and on the other side as well, they need to have access to basic social rights and economy, otherwise there is no security. So there is no development if there is no security, no security if no development. Somalia, for instance, to improve the condition of situation is linked as well to how we can do to improve their ability to protect their citizens.
The European Commission is dealing first with those countries in the east of Africa. West African countries also have contributed large numbers of migrants and refugees to this year's European migration crisis. Polak says the roots of their problems are closely linked to terrorism.
We're talking now of the Horn of Africa, but yeah, we'll announce new projects as well in the Sahel. So giving the example of Mali or Niger, Mali and Niger are asking us to strengthen their cooperation on tracking, you know, and gathering information on anti-terrorist action. And but here, what I'm talking about, this trust fund is really more focused on the capacity of the authorities in the field, mostly of border management, control, and as well the capacity to tackle the groups, you know, the criminal groups that are really doing human trafficking and abusing refugees that need international protection.
Some European governments have begun separating political refugees who can stay from economic migrants who will be returned to the country of origin. Observers worry that those decisions may be made too swiftly, based only on country of origin, not on the risk of political persecution. Many Africans will be returned as economic migrants. But the question of voluntary return is to be made by individual European governments.
Of course, it could as well include voluntary returns of, take the example of Somalia, but other nationalities from Europe to Africa. So it's like it could include that as well, an activity. But all this, we believe, work only if you work on our front, and that's why this fund is very strict about trying to promote all type of action, economy, social, this migration part and security, because if you take one, like a puzzle that will never be complete, and we're not going to reach the objective we try to reach together with our African partners.
This is not the first time the European Union has offered social and economic development funds to African countries, but the focus this year and for many years to come promises to be driven by a need to stabilize populations in Europe and Africa. This is David Arnold from VOA in Washington, D.C.
Eighteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Three truckloads of Boko Haram extremists struck Maiduguri in northern Nigeria today with rocket-propelled grenades and a number of suicide bombers. The Nigerian military says nearly 30 residents and 10 suicide bombers were killed. Nigerian military authorities say insurgents conducted assaults on four southwestern entrances to Maiduguri, the birthplace of Boko Haram and the capital of Borno State. Major General Lamidi Adeosun told the reporters 29 people have been killed and 88 injured in attacks that began Sunday night. Meanwhile, in northern Cameroon, Reuters says three suicide bombers attacked villages over the past 2 days. Two women blew themselves up today when vigilantes prevented them from entering a marketplace in the town of Bodo in Makari district. One vigilante was slightly injured. On Saturday, a bomber died and two bystanders were wounded in Tolokomari, a village in Kolofata. Many communities in northern Cameroon have been struck by Boko Haram militants and suicide bombers in recent months. Thousands of Nigerians have sought refuge in Cameroon as a result of 6 years of terrorist attacks by Nigeria-based Boko Haram. The Cameroon military has joined an 8,700-man military force in the region to try to defeat Boko Haram.
international human rights organization Amnesty International is calling on authorities in Cameroon to reveal the fate of 130 people who were detained by government forces over a year ago. Amnesty says they were detained as part of security operations against Boko Haram. Amnesty says more than 200 boys and men were arrested by security forces in the villages of Magdeme and Duble. The government claims that 70 suspected Boko Haram members were arrested and that 25 of them died that night in custody. However, the whereabouts of at least 130 remaining people are still unknown. Iliara Alegrazi is Amnesty International's researcher for Central Africa. She spoke with me about their call for Cameroonian authorities to shed light on the missing people.
Amnesty International has collected information on a range of crimes under international law and human rights violations committed by the Cameroonian security forces in 2014 and in 2015. And we have also documented in detail some specific cases of, for example, arbitrary arrests, mass arrests, unlawful killings and enforced disappearances. Basically, the Cameroonian security forces have conducted several search and security operations to fight Boko Haram. And in one of the most extreme cordon and search operations documented by Amnesty International, at least 200 people have been arrested. This happened exactly 1 year ago on the 27th of December 2014 in two villages in the far north of Cameroon. In the same operation also, not only 200 people have been arrested, but also 8 people have been killed, including a child, and civil buildings have been burned down and many possessions have been stolen and destroyed.
These 200 boys and men who were arrested, were they arrested based on being Boko Haram suspects?
Exactly, based on suspicions of being Boko Haram fighters.
What is the government saying about these people?
Basically, the fate of most of those arrested in these two villages remains unknown. At least 25 of them have died in custody during the night of their arrest in a cell in the HQ of the Gendarmerie in the Maroua, which is the main city of the far north region of Cameroon. 45 have been registered in the Maroua prison, while at least 130 remain unaccounted for, presumed to be victims of enforced disappearances, with some evidence, I would say, suggesting more might have died while in the custody of the security forces. We have asked the Cameroonian authorities to provide information regarding these people, but so far no information has been provided. And although an internal administrative investigation has been launched, this is yet to even identify those people who have died in custody and reveal the location of the bodies, and also to interview a number of key witnesses.
How are the families of these missing people dealing with the situation?
Some family members have even tried to get information from the prison authorities regarding the fate and the whereabouts of their loved ones. But so far, no information has been provided, and even some family members have been turned away, have been threatened, and have been asked also for money to get information. So 1 year on, no step has been taken by the authorities to basically reveal the whereabouts of those missing.
The arrest of the Cameroonian authorities on the suspected Boko Haram militants, are they in line with international law or are they violating human rights?
According to the information and the evidence collected by Amnesty International, we believe that some security operations conducted by the Cameroonian forces are not in line with human rights and human rights standards. And we believe that in order to really fight Boko Haram, the Cameroonian authorities must make sure that all civilians without discrimination are protected against Boko Haram, and also that they should, you know, ensure the safety, the security, and the protection of those who provide information regarding Boko Haram suspects, for example. This is the case of members of the vigilantes committees and those who are collaborating with the security forces. Unfortunately, some of them have been victims of attacks by Boko Haram in retaliation for them providing information to the authorities.
Also, based on your report that was released last September, you documented just how Boko Haram, they have slaughtered more than 400 civilians living in northern Cameroon. So I guess this is the security forces' response to that?
Absolutely. The security forces in Cameroon have arrested at least 1,000 people since 2014, since basically the fight against Boko Haram became more and more important, and also since attacks and riots by this armed group became increasingly more violent, especially along the border. Those arrested have been taken to several prisons across the country, particularly in the north of Cameroon, and we have documented very bad prison conditions where detainees are living in overcrowded prisons with no water, no food, and no sleeping materials whatsoever, and especially very long pre-trial detention.
Ilaria Alegrossi is Amnesty International's researcher for Central Africa. She spoke with me from Rome, Italy.
There has been mixed reaction in Cameroon following a Transparency International report that placed the Central African state as one of the most corrupt African nations alongside South Africa, Ghana, Nigeria, and Liberia. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
22-year-old university student Celine Ateba struggles at the Yaoundé train station to secure a ticket to travel to the northern part of Cameroon. She says after she was informed all available seats had been taken, a worker at the railway company approached her and asked for a bribe to sell her a ticket.
La corruption dans notre pays, malheureusement, est une gangrène.
She says corruption is a cancer that is eating Cameroon. She says in hospitals, train and police stations, public offices and schools, corruption is practiced openly and some people are no longer ashamed of it. She says it is unfortunate that our country is one of the most corrupt nations in the world. In a new report, the non-governmental organization Transparency International found that Cameroon was among the most corrupt states in sub-Saharan Africa. The survey included 43,000 respondents from 28 countries who were interviewed between March and September 2015. Issa Chiruma Bakari, a Cameroon government spokesperson, describes the report as biased and says Transparency International is trying to soil Cameroon's image.
Le rapport présenté par cette ONG comme constituant.
He says the group's report has no viable data, but only opinions collected from 1,000 people without any precise criteria. He says it provides no statistics on material acts of corruption and accuses Transparency International of undermining efforts to economically develop Cameroon. But Dedoni Masigams, chairperson of Cameroon's National Anti-Corruption Commission, says corruption remains a serious problem in the country. He says he is happy there is growing awareness as many more Cameroonians have been lodging complaints at his commission.
Je crois qu'il faudrait que nous soyons humbles pour reconnaître.
He says people should acknowledge that complaints of corrupt practices have increased from barely 200 per year 5 years ago to 3,000 in 2015. He says he has observed an increasing willingness of Cameroonians to report corrupt government officials. In its report, Transparency International says corruption creates and increases poverty and exclusion. It says whistleblowing is key to fighting graft, but that many people are afraid to come forward as they feel it is too dangerous. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The first day of restarted peace talks for Burundi was held today in Uganda. And three truckloads of Boko Haram extremists struck Maiduguri in northern Nigeria today with rocket-propelled grenades and a number of suicide bombers. Coming up, we'll have music from Guinea-Bissau. And in our feature segment, Africa enters 2016 amid looming food shortages in several regions. I'm Kim Lewis with the Heya Swuhi Band. We're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand the Special Olympics tops your sports report.
Kim, 2015 was a special year for the Special Olympics, the international organization that uses the power of sports to help people with intellectual disabilities. In late July, Special Olympics held its marquee event, the World Games, in Los Angeles, California. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama officially opened the games at the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. About 6,500 athletes from 177 countries participated in the 2015 Special Olympics World Games, which featured competition in 25 sports. Meanwhile, in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, Special Olympics and Catholic Relief Services have begun a youth athletes program. VOA's Jill Craig reports from Nairobi.
Living in a Nairobi slum is not easy. Electricity is scarce, clean water expensive, sanitation poor, and quality education hard to come by. But for children living with disabilities, slum life becomes even more difficult.
It's one thing if you're a kid with special needs or intellectual disabilities in a developed country. But when you consider kids growing up in a slum in Nairobi or any other slum in a major urban area in Africa, there's a huge need there, I think.
Nancy McNally of Catholic Relief Services says there are additional challenges for children with disabilities in Kenya.
If they have intellectual disabilities, then sometimes they're ostracized by their own communities, by their own parents. You know, there are some superstitions that the kids might be cursed.
So to help these children and provide a support system for their parents, Catholic Relief Services and Special Olympics started a young athletes program in the Nairobi slum of Kawangware. The program caters to children with intellectual disabilities ages 2 to 7 who come to an early childhood development center twice a week to participate in activities with other children. Social workers also conduct home visits, helping parents with emotional encouragement and positive parenting techniques. At the same time, parents like Justice Idalia are able to get support from other parents dealing with similar issues. That's important because Idalia says caring for his son Jason is a round-the-clock responsibility.
These children need a very lot of care because you can't leave these children for another neighbor, for a neighbor to take care of him. You are the one who is responsible.
Parents rarely get a break because even schooling is a problem. Anne Mushiri says many parents here cannot afford what are called special schools that service children with disabilities.
Most of them don't have a school to go to because the special schools are too expensive for them, cannot afford it. And then again, some schools don't want these children, so they just stay with them at home.
Jason's dad is unusual because most of the children's caregivers are single mothers whose husbands often leave them.
Most fathers don't like this child with a disability. Most parents, like dad, they see the child with the disability is like an outcast.
But Idalia, who is actively parenting his son, says the program has helped.
Because right now he has got a very good improvement.
There are currently 74 children in the program, and organizers say they hope to expand. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
In African athletics, one of the year's most emotional events was Haile Gebrselassie's symbolic farewell race at last month's Great Ethiopian Run in Addis Ababa. In this sunny side of sports highlight for 2015, let's listen in again to my report. The two-time Olympic champion, regarded as one of the greatest runners in history, was surrounded by well-wishers both before and after the popular 10-kilometer road race through the Ethiopian capital. Before the race, 42-year-old Haile Gebrselassie said it was a special moment to have a symbolic end to his record-breaking career on home soil.
Yeah, it is. It is, especially here in Ethiopia. It's going to be this one as the last one. Ah, a little bit, you know, just sad. I know, what can I do? It's just over 28 years running. This will be, you know, the last one here in Ethiopia.
Haile Gebrselassie finished the race in about 33 minutes. He says he could have gone faster, but he spent the early part of the race zigging and zagging through the huge crowd of runners. More than 40,000 people participated in the Great Ethiopian Run, which organizers describe as Africa's biggest road race. Haile crossed the line barefoot in honor of another two-time Olympic champion from Ethiopia, the late Abebe Bikila, who was most famous for winning a marathon gold medal in the 1960 Rome Olympics while running barefoot. After finishing, Haile gave some special thanks.
I would like to say thank you all the people who are supporting me the last 28 years, especially my wife and the children and the people of Ethiopia and the whole.
Haile Gebrselassie is one of the founders of the Great Ethiopian Run. He fired the starter's pistol to get the runners going and then joined in with the masses to run. Meanwhile, before the race, reporter Skinder Ferru caught up with Haile Gebrselassie's longtime Dutch manager.
Hello, I'm Jos Hermans. I'm based and I'm living in the Netherlands. I met Haile Gebrselassie when he was 17 years old in 1991 at Jan Meda cross country. And since then, we worked together as a manager, coach, friend, and we will be friends forever.
Let me take you back to that Jan Meda event. What happened then?
It was a cross country in it was selection race, and he became fifth in that race. He didn't win, but because of that selection race,
it was 10 kilometers.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, around 10k, because he was still junior. Can be also 8 kilometers. He was he was then selected for the World Cross Champions Juniors 1 or 2 months later in Belgium in Antwerp. And he competed there. I'm quite sure he was number 7 then in the World Championships cross country in Antwerp, and then in 1992 he was second in the World Championships cross country in juniors in Boston. And anyway, since that date in February 1991, we worked together.
In Jan Meda, what were you doing at that time? Were you recruiting, you know, athletes? Tell me how you approached him first.
Ah, okay. No, I came already in 1982 for the first time to Ethiopia, and then I was scouting athletes for the Rotterdam Marathon. I was the organizer of Rotterdam Marathon, so I scouted
Balena. You were scouting Balena in Samo in Dazen.
Yes, and Mekonnen and all the other athletes. And then I came more often to Ethiopia, and Ethiopia has a special place in my heart already from the days of Abebe Bikila. You know, when I saw the movie from the Olympics in 1960 and 64, I was a young boy, 10 years, 14 years, and you know, somebody from a very, very far away country, barefoot, winning the Olympics in Rome, and it was for me like an incredible story. And since then, I always liked to go to Ethiopia. And so in 1982, I came, and then I came more and more often, and I was many times every year at the Jan Meda for the cross country. And then in 1991, I saw Haile and a few other athletes, and I made contact with them and asked them if I could represent them, and that's how we started to work together.
Mm-hmm. So you represented him for how many years as his manager?
Yeah, from the beginning, 1991, today or this year is 24 years.
What is the most unforgettable moment in Haile's athletics life for you, especially?
Oh, there's too many unforgettable moments, fantastic moments of winning races, his first world record in the 5,000 meters in Hengelo in my country. Then another one, he broke the world record 5,000 meters in Zurich with 11 seconds, amazingly. It's nearly 1 second per lap. Of course, everybody talks about 2000 Olympics in Sydney where he won from Paul Thacker. The amazing thing about that performance is that he was injured already several months. He was not training completely. Actually, we had already an appointment in Finland to go to a doctor to have an operation for his tendon. He still decided to go to run for his country, and he was winning that race not only on his talents as a runner, but also especially on how strong his mind was. And another fantastic race for me was when he was breaking the world record in the marathon in 2:03:59.
Are you surprised that he decided to stop running at this time?
Yes, I know. Yes, it's time because he gets older. It's more difficult. The body is not that young anymore. No, because he loves running. He will run forever. And it was always difficult to pin him down. We have to pin him down about saying goodbye. Many times we talked already about it maybe 5 years ago, 7 years ago. And he could never say, you know, when do I want to stop? He highly chooses his own moments. And he has a few times, he has already said before, one time in New York,
yeah.
One time in New York, and then this year again in Manchester. You know, that's spontaneous. It comes from himself. It was never discussed between him and myself. And now, you know, of course, it's fantastic if he can run in Addis Ababa for, you know, hundreds of thousands of people to watch him and enjoy and, you know, say farewell. But I'm sure many people here in Addis Ababa and Ethiopia will still see him running early morning in the woods outside Addis Ababa. So in that way, he will never stop.
How many Ethiopian athletes do you represent now?
I don't count, but there's many. I mean, probably at least 50 or 60 Ethiopian athletes we are working with. It's not only me. We have a big office in Holland. We work with 30 people. We have a very good coaches. Ketana Tesema is one of our coaches here. Valentine Trau, he's one of the persons in our office who's also here now that works with many of the athletes. And we have a wonderful group of athletes, young athletes also. So it's hard work, but it's also a big pleasure.
That's Jos Hermans, the longtime Dutch manager of Ethiopian star Haile Gebrselassie. And Jos was talking with reporter Skinder Farou in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Hello, this is Haile Gebrselassie. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sport on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Finally, the Sunny Side of Sports remembers Harlem Globetrotters basketball star Meadowlark Lemon, who died Sunday at age 83. Nicknamed the Clown Prince of Basketball, Meadowlark entertained millions of fans all over the world with his infectious humor and on-court antics. My destiny was to make people happy, said Meadowlark at his 2003 induction ceremony into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Mission accomplished, Meadowlark. Rest in peace, Meadowlark Lemon. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and I agree. I think Meadowlark, he brought a lot of joy to a lot of people. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Africa entering 2016 amid looming food shortages in several regions. And next, access to energy hindering economic development in Africa. But first, some music. It is Nino Galisa from Guinea-Bissau with Africa Today.
Africa Today. Today.
today, Africa. We don't want war.
We don't.
Africa today,
Africa.
We don't want sadness.
We don't.
Africa today,
Africa.
We don't want hunger.
We don't.
Africa today,
Africa.
We don't want more arms.
We don't.
Lisa from Guinea, Bissau, with Africa Today.
Well, 2015 has been a hungry year for much of the African continent. In East and Southern Africa, El Nino and climate fluctuations have provoked serious crises. Conflicts in South Sudan and the Central African Republic have had the same effect, as have poverty and a population boom in the Sahel. Africa is entering 2016 amid looming food shortages in several regions. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell takes a look at what these separate crises have in common.
Hunger has hit Africa hard this year as climate change, conflict, and enduring poverty have ravaged multiple countries and left tens of millions of people in dire straits. Countries as diverse as South Sudan, Malawi, and the Central African Republic have sounded the alarm in recent months. Some, like many southern and East African nations, are suffering from the double whammy of two droughts in a row. Others, like the Central African Republic and Sudan, are in trouble because of conflict and massive displacement. The UN's World Food Programme says sub-Saharan Africa already has the world's highest prevalence of hunger. One person in four is undernourished. Every day in Africa, 23 million children go to school hungry. The agency's David Orr says that in the lower half of Africa, where weather is the main culprit, 2015 has been an unusually difficult year.
I think what makes things different this year is the combination of drought and then an El Nino weather event coming right after that, so that people are effectively being hit by two consecutive years of reduced rainfall, and it's particularly difficult on a region where 70% of the population are subsistence farmers.
But African governments say they too have an important role to play, and that the hunger crisis is their failure as well. Malawi's Minister of Finance earlier this year described his nation's hunger situation as a scandal and pledged to do more. In Ethiopia, the government has committed a record sum, $192 million, amid news that as many as 10 million people will face critical food shortages next year because of a crippling drought. John Graham, Save the Children's country director in Ethiopia, told VOA News that African governments need to do more as international donor budgets are increasingly squeezed by crises elsewhere in the world. But he says they still can't do it alone.
The Ethiopian government has stepped up. They pledged about $200 million, which is far more than I've ever seen them pledge for any other emergency. And so I think that they're really trying to do their best. But I think the international community should stand by them and also make big pledges. And so far, you know, I've been here for 18 years, and this is the slowest response that I've seen to this type of crisis.
Elsewhere on the continent, such as in South Sudan, the problems are trickier. There, 2 years of brutal conflict have played a huge role in pushing hundreds of thousands of people to starvation. But aid officials say aid agencies can only do so much on their own, or again.
We and the other humanitarian agencies are there to support the governments, and that's more and more what we are doing. not just providing lean season relief programs and other forms of food assistance, but actually giving technical support and institutional capacity to really increase the ability of governments to solve these problems for themselves.
That, everyone acknowledges, is a long and difficult process, but one that governments and donors need to tackle if they want to avoid a repeat of 2015. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Experts say that one of the main challenges hindering economic development in Africa is access to energy. In many parts of the continent, power is either not accessible or not affordable. Solar energy has become a viable solution in many parts of rural Africa, where many millions of households were dependent on more carbon-intensive options like charcoal and kerosene. But access to solar energy comes with its own challenges to these households. The most common one is how to fix the solar lamps and related solar home systems. In Uganda, Abu Musuza, a young technician, is building a network of franchised rural technicians to respond to these needs. VOA's Jackson Mfungani reached him in the capital, Kampala.
I founded Village Energy pretty much from my own background. I was fortunate enough to be born in an urban area, but also had the chance to live between both urban and rural areas and experience firsthand the energy poverty that is in rural areas.
Before you started this organization, did you have a background in energy production?
I actually did not. It's pretty much the experience I gained in the space of social entrepreneurship and learning from other social entrepreneurs, Ashoka Salo, who are working in the space of energy.
As a young entrepreneur, what are some of the challenges that you faced and had to overcome?
Well, of course, first and foremost is, you know, the financial challenge that, you know, everyone goes through. But certainly coming into a space where we did not have, you know, that much experience, it was learning on the job. So that made things a bit more difficult to get off the ground. However, we did manage to navigate those. But some of the other issues were around the whole fact that there's a lack of trust for solar solutions, particularly in rural areas where most of kerosene is burned. So this stems from people who earlier supplied very bad quality products that broke. And so it becomes a lot more difficult to sell them a new product.
Are you selling similar products or just a similar technology?
Well, initially we were selling similar products, but we've since transitioned our business to focus on the issue of a lack of after-sales services in rural areas, because people's products, 75% of the time, people's solar products break because of user error. So they have not been well educated on how to use the product and they break. No one is available to provide them a new part, to provide them, you know, a repair service. And so our work now focuses largely on building a network of solar repair shops that will ensure that anyone who has a solar system and it breaks can access a repair or spare part within 48 hours.
And where do you find the technicians to operate these shops?
We basically work with young people who are self-trained, who are phone and radio repairmen, and have been providing these services in rural communities for many, many years. So we use their experience, use their skills and their talents, and retrain them to basically provide solar repairs, maintenance, and installation. And then we also build for them a business, provide them a brand, which is a Village Energy brand, repaint their shops, their radio shacks, and give them the identity of Village Energy so that that builds trust in the communities, and then provide them a supply chain of spare parts to ensure that, you know, they can provide the service whenever it is required.
Do you have to train any new technicians who are kind of new to the field, like young people who probably needed employment and are interested in getting trained?
For now, we have not done that. We are actually currently in talks with Makerere University here in Kampala and Strathmore University in Nairobi to design a solar course, a six-week course that can basically just get someone who had no prior experience or training in electricity and basically give them the training to be technicians.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jackson Witt, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The death of a mother is the greatest misfortune for a young family. When a woman dies in childbirth, the newborn's own chances of survival diminish tenfold. That child and any siblings are less likely to receive health care and to go to school, and the family as a whole is now more likely to suffer economic hardship. Yet every 2 minutes, another mother dies during pregnancy or childbirth. More than half of the deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. That is why in June 2012, the United States and the government of Norway partnered with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the private sector initiative Merck for Mothers, and the Every Mother Counts campaign to found the Saving Mothers Giving Life initiative. Saving Mothers Giving Life is a 5-year initiative that seeks to reduce maternal mortality by half and improve health in places where women are dying at alarming rates during pregnancy and childbirth. It was initially implemented in 4 districts each in Uganda and Zambia, with a focus on labor, delivery, and the first 48 hours postpartum, the time period in which some 2/3 of maternal deaths and nearly half of infant deaths occur. Early reports indicated that the program was working, so it was expanded in 2014 to an additional 12 districts in Zambia and another 6 districts in Uganda. Now the program has reached its halfway point, and the results are astonishingly good. In Uganda, the institutional maternal mortality rate has fallen by 45% since the beginning of the initiative, and thanks to a strong training and educational campaign, by 41% at the community level. In Zambia, institutional mortality, meaning in a hospital or clinic, has fallen by 53% in the target districts, and nearly 90% of women are now giving birth in a facility compared to 63% at the outset of the initiative. As a result of this success, the partnership is expanding the program to Nigeria, a country that accounts for 14% of the world's maternal deaths and 1/4 of the world's newborn deaths, with an initial focus on the southeastern state of Cross River. Surviving childbirth should not be a matter of luck or where you live or how much money you have. Together, we are working to make that a reality.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations, VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.